This is the HOD Hour with Stan Claff.
And I'm Stan Claff, and good evening. And I'm from the Hebrew Order of David International, organization that is 115 years old with its foundation, its roots in Johannesburg in 1904. And we're going to be talking about mitzvot. And I have with me as my guest, an honored guest, Rabbi Gedalia Kaufman from Eisha Torah. And we're going to be talking mitzvot. And welcome, Rabbi.
Thank you, Stan. So nice to be back on the show.
Yes, and so you nearly three times and you become a regular. We'll have to save your seat. Rabbi, I asked you to come on because I want to explore the question of mitzvot in relation to men in the community and particularly the Hebrew Order of David, which of course has as its foundation helping those less fortunate than ourselves. But I think it's important to start off with I know there's 613 mitzvot and we will never get through them tonight, but could we start with tefillin and tell us the background to it and the importance of tefillin?
Sure. So I think as a starting point, we should assume nothing. We should assume that our audience doesn't necessarily know even what tefillin is. So what is tefillin? So one of the, as you mentioned, 613 mitzvot, commandments in the Torah, is the mitzvah of wearing tefillin. So tefillin, actually the Torah doesn't call it tefillin. The Torah calls it totafot, which is, we more commonly call it tefillin. And tefillin are basically, they are two black boxes. They are boxes made of leather from a kosher animal. They are made by hand. It takes quite a long and painstaking process to make a pair of tefillin. And there are many, many detailed laws involved in making a kosher pair of tefillin. There is each box has leather straps, also from a kosher animal. The straps must be dyed black. The boxes are black. And inside of these boxes are parchments. Four different parchments in the arm tefillin, and in the head one, and it is written the same thing in each of them, which is from four different places in the Torah. And these boxes are taken, and one is literally strapped onto the arm, tied on to the if you are assuming you're a righty, you tie it on your left arm. If you are, it's the other way around if you're left-handed. So if you're right-handed, you put it on your left arm just over the bicep, in such a way when you put your arm down, it is facing towards your heart. The straps go around your arm. There are different customs about how exactly to do the tying around the hand, but you go around the arm seven times and then around the hand. And then there's the second box goes on the head, and it has straps which go encircle the head. And then there, the two straps come down, one on either side in the front of the chest, going down to approximately the level of the waist. So this is the mitzvah of tefillin. It's familiar to any Jewish bar mitzvah boy, because only when it is a mitzvah which is specifically associated with men, and it is only once a boy hits the age of bar mitzvah that he begins to put on tefillin. Sometimes about a month before to practice, so that by the time that his bar mitzvah comes along, where he turns 13 and he is obligated to keep the mitzvahs like any other Jewish adult male, so they practice the month before. So there's a bracha which is said before you put on the arm tefillin, a bracha before the head tefillin. And these are typically worn only during nowadays, we'll maybe discuss a little bit in detail why, during the morning prayers, during shachris, is that it will be put on and worn for the duration of Shachris. So that's just, to make sure that we're all on the same page and everybody listening knows what they are.
In the mitzvot, there's actually two mitzvot around the tefillin, because one is for putting it on your head and the other one for putting on it on the arm. So why are they not just one? Why is it two?
So actually, according to some, like, for example, you've perhaps heard of the great sage, the Rambam. So he actually does count them as two separate mitzvot. Each one has its own blessing, said, So there are those who actually count them as two of the 613 mitzvot. But it is something which is quite, closely identified with becoming bar mitzvah and especially with prayer and with davening. And it's important because, to understand, when we have associations with something, is those things, especially when you make associations as a young person, is those have a very profound impression on how we relate to things for the rest of our lives. And, you know, the impressions we get of something when we're 13 years old are not always necessarily the most accurate or correct impressions. You know, there's you've obviously heard of Kirk Douglas, right? He's a famous actor from he was quite big in the 40s and the 50s.
The Bible,
Et
cetera.
And so there's actually interesting. There's an Eshet Torah rabbi in L.A. years ago who actually met him, and wanted to learn with him. Wanted to make a learning session with him, and he wasn't necessarily so keen to do so. He was getting a little bit involved in Judaism. He was quite old already. I think he was at least in his 70s, maybe even his 80s. And he was a little bit resistant. And the rabbi said something to him. And I heard Kirk Douglas tell this story, that the rabbi asked him, if you, everything you knew about life, let's say anything you knew about love, it sort of stopped when you were 13. And all the impressions you had from your 30s, what you knew about life. He says, would you think that would be sufficient? And he said, no, what did I know when I was 13? I didn't know anything. You know, I mean, I was young and I was foolish. So he said, you know, after your bar mitzvah, you left. That was it. You never went back to shul again after your bar mitzvah. He says, so everything you know from when you were 13. So everything you know about Judaism from the perspective of a 13-year-old boy. So he said, you have a good point. And he actually agreed to learn with him, and he actually became involved and became actually somewhat observant towards the end of his life.
And his son as well.
His son, I don't know. Do you know his son, Mike Douglas?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So his son also apparently has also become Jewish in the inverted commas, and he's practicing, according to what I understand.
Interesting. So you know what? So a lot of boys, unfortunately, their first exposure to tefillin is if they go to a school where there's davening every day, there's prayer every morning. Sometimes it is compulsory. And they are required to put on tefillin. They're required to attend the morning prayers. And there may be paper airplanes flying and spitballs flying around and teachers looking very cross and yelling at them. And so a lot of boys' experience and their impressions of prayer and of putting on tefillin is not necessarily the most spiritual or the most uplifting.
More of a chore,
more maybe of a joke, but there are quite a few people who that is their experience, you know, as a 13-year-old boy and throughout their school years of tefillin, which is quite unfortunate, because tefillin is a very, very, very deep and a very meaningful. I mean, like all of the mitzvahs, of course, but it is imbued with a tremendous depth and beauty and meaning. If you think about the fact, I mean, what you're actually doing is you're taking certain words from the Torah and you're strapping them on to your body. You're tying them to your body. That's quite a radical thing to do. So the first thing I think we would want to ask is what are the words? What's inside of the tefillin? You know, this is something which God tells us is these words are so important that I want
right,
you,
absolutely.
I want you to tie them onto your head and tie them onto your arm. So what do you have any idea what it says inside?
I'm not too clued up on that, I have to be honest.
So there's, you're not the only one. So if you look, so first of all, you're familiar with the Shema. So
yes.
So the first two paragraphs of the Shema.
Right.
Are two of the things that are included in
I would have tefillin. Imagined that.
Right. So, and then there's two other different, paragraphs from the Torah. But what do these things talk about? So what they talk about is, it talks about things like remembering the Exodus from Egypt. Right. It was the seminal event in Jewish history where we were forged into a people. It was our experience of slavery in Egypt and then how God came and through a year-long process of incredible miracles, wonders, signs, right? There's the plagues, the sort of ripping away of the veil of nature, showing that God was behind everything, and He was the only power. It tells us to remember that. It tells us to teach that to our children. The words in the tefillin acknowledge the fact of God's existence. They are discussing God's personal involvement with the Jewish people. That the fact there's what's called hashkacha, that there he didn't just wind up like you know wind up toy, and then let the world go on its own. Is he actually did not only create the world, but he is intimately involved in every aspect of creation, of people's lives, of what happens here, what happens in history, what happens to us as nations, what happens to us as individuals. And then, of course, the Shema, right, where we acknowledge the absolute oneness, the absolute oneness of God, where we acknowledge there are no other powers, talks about the other mitzvahs, other commandments, the commandment to love God, the commandment to be in awe of God, accepting upon ourselves the God's authority, that acknowledging that He is the King, is that that He is our Creator, and that it tells us the commandments, that it talks about doing the mitzvot, the fact that it discusses our responsibility, the human being's responsibility towards God. And we take all of these things and we tie them onto the arm and tie them onto the head.
So by the time you've done this, you've already covered some of the other mitzvot, because the first mitzvot, or first mitzvah, is that you would acknowledge the presence of God.
Certainly, if you're putting on tefillin, one would assume, although I suppose someone could be doing it out of habit, but one would assume that they're putting on tefillin because they're aware that there's a God who commanded them to put on tefillin. So that already is, that's an acknowledgement. To do a commandment means you're acknowledging that someone commanded you, right? Otherwise, why are you doing it? So right. There is an acknowledgement of that, of course. But there is, so much of the mitzvah actually has to do with, the awareness that you have, the focus that you have when you're putting them on. And there's actually a paragraph, in the Siddur before you put on tefillin, which you actually should ideally read. It's brought down actually it's quoted in the Shulchan Aruch and the Code of Jewish Law, that you should actually say these words where you're actually focusing on what you're doing and why you're doing it. Because it's so easy to slip into sort of doing something by rote, doing it out of habit, doing it quickly. And that really robs the whole act of the incredible meaning which is in it. So, what would you think the arm represents?
This is too much of a quiz for me.
What do you do with your arm?
I'm scared to answer.
What do you do with your arms?
Embracing the religion. Embracing God.
You're so frum, hey? Stan, I can't believe it. Making me look better. Yeah, you sound like the rabbi. Your arms are, you do things with your arm. It's doing.
Right.
It's actions. Okay? And your head. What is your head? Your head is, of course, it's the intellect. It's your thoughts. So we take these ideas from the Torah, these literally the parchments which have to be written on, they're written on, klaf, your surname, yeah, your surname comes from,
yes.
Klaf, you pronounce it klaf, but in Hebrew it's pronounced klaf.
Absolutely.
Klaf is a part of the animal skin, it's part of the hide, it's written on this parchment, and in the boxes, and we tie them on. So the arm represents action, the head represents, is the world of thought. So that everything that we do, all of our actions, and all of our intent, and all of our focus, and all of our purpose, should be dedicated to one thing, which is everything which it says inside the tefillin, which is to developing our connection, our relationship with the Creator.
So, if you had to look at these mitzvot, and there's 613, and clearly you can't do all of them, and in fact, in your lifetime, you're not going to come across a large percentage of them, because they just don't exist, and the things in there that are on not to do, and the opportunity wouldn't probably present itself in your lifetime. So, the commandment to do all 613 is actually well nigh impossible. I mean, you can strive towards that, but can you actually achieve it? Because I don't see it.
Well, you are correct that it is actually impossible for any one person to do all 613 commandments, and that is for a very simple reason. So first of all, there are some commandments which apply only to men.
Yes.
There are some which apply only to women. There are some commandments which apply only to someone who is, let's say, from the tribe of Levi, which is the
Kohanim
tribe, or there's Levi, and then Kohanim, the family within the tribe of Levi, which serve as the priests. So there are certain mitzvot which apply only to Kohanim. In addition to that, is that there are many, many mitzvot which, unfortunately, we are not in a position to do at all today, simply because they require the majority of the people of the Jewish people to be living in the land of Israel. They require a temple to be built there, for our holy temple to be there. And there is a significant number of mitzvot which simply because of the circumstances we're in, is that we don't have the opportunity to fulfill, which of course is a loss to us.
So could you do one or two of these mitzvot repetitively and then cover up the ones that you couldn't do. So you do one, you do three of one, and you've got extra points for the process, or is that a bit too glib?
Yeah, it's not so simple that it works like that, but there's, it's also, you know, to discuss it in terms of points, you know, what is a mitzvah? What is a mitzvah in general? You know, you get point, you do something and you get points up in heaven, and you know, when after 120 years you go up to heaven and you get a pat on the back, you know, here's all your points.
Well, in my thinking, I don't look that far ahead because I don't know when I'll ever get there. But at the same time, I look at it in from a personal point of view, because I would assume, like everybody else, if you do something worthwhile, you get a warm, fuzzy feeling, and you know that you've done something. I don't need to broadcast it, but I know in myself that what has been done has been something worthwhile. So I would presume that a lot of these things are aimed, of these mitzvot are aimed at that, to from your own personal point of view. I understand that there's a greater power looking on, and then one day there'll be a judgment. But can you for oneself to be able to do as much as possible for the right reasons, I think is essential.
Absolutely, and I think is a very important awareness to have, is that I think people make a mistake. Because you think that, well, first of all, on several counts. Number one is, if you ask your average person what's a mitzvah, so they probably would say it's a good deed. Many of the things we do are very hard to characterize as a good deed. And maybe we can discuss that in a bit more detail when we come back.
Right, we're coming back. We're just having a short break. We have to pay the rent, and we'll be back.
This is the HOD Hour with Stan Claff.
And we're back, and we're talking to Rabbi Gedalia Kaufman from Aisha Torah. We're talking about mitzvot. If you want to participate in this discussion and you want to send us an SMS or queries for the rabbi, you can SMS 34519 with your query. We'll try to answer. I'm sure it's within the knowledge base of the rabbi, who is an accomplished person in the community. From Aisha Torah, has written a number of books, and is certain, and Aisha Torah doing leading work in the community. So, to put it into context, from the Hebrew Order of David's point of view, we are an organization which essentially is based on charity, doing good for others, being charitable in giving to those less fortunate than ourselves, and I think it's a platform for members to be able to perform these mitzvot. You don't have to give of your own money, which in itself is giving charity, but you can give of your time, which I think is also a mitzvah, to be able to assist those in need and in some way, and in a community-based projects for the community, by the community, and by the members of the Hebrew Order of David, who give of their own time voluntarily and freely. So, Rabbi, put us into the context of, can I just ask you first, before that, actually, a question that's been on my mind. So there's 613 mitzvot, and do they have equal status, or are they ranked in order of what you should be doing? So you wake up in the morning, you go to shacharis, you lay tefillin, you do that, you've done the first mitzvah of the day, I'm assuming. But that doesn't mean that that's the first and that's the most important mitzvah. So I suppose there must be some sort of ranking, or do they all rank equally?
It's an interesting question. When it comes to positive commandments, certainly it's a bit difficult to say which one is more important than the other. In fact, our sages tell us that you shouldn't take any mitzvah lightly, because it's very difficult for us to know from our perspective, which is considered to be a light mitzvah, a not so important mitzvah, which is considered to be a more important mitzvah. So certainly with regard to positive commandments, it's not always easy to know which one is going to be more quote-unquote important than others. There are times we are told, for example, the mitzvah of Torah learning says is equivalent to all the other mitzvah combined. So sometimes we are told that some mitzvahs are very, very, are weighted more heavily. When it comes to negative commandments, as we are told the punishments, you know, what the Torah punishments are for different commandments, and you can get a sense from how severe the punishment is for something, that how serious it is when it comes to negative commandments. And the truth is, the word punishment is maybe not the best. Let's say consequence, you know, the consequence.
Yes, but some do have punishment. I mean, and the punishment is laid down.
Correct. But I think, you know, this gets us back to what we were talking about before the break, which is how to properly relate to what is a mitzvah in the first place, and to the whole concept of what we call reward and punishment. Because one could easily make a mistake and think that, you know, if I do a mitzvah, I'm really doing God a favor, right? I'm doing you a favor, God, because I'm doing this. So if you go all the way back to really what is the beginning of the Jewish people, and that is with Abraham. And when the Torah tells us about Abraham, the very first parsha, really, in the Torah, the portion of the Torah where it discusses Abraham and his life at length, we see the very first time where God speaks to Abraham. He receives a prophecy, and the very first words that God tells Abraham when he is giving him the commandment, he's asking him to leave his land and to head towards what is the land of Israel, okay, at the time called the land of Canaan. And he says the words to Abraham, he says, Lech Lecho. He said, you should go for yourself. Go for yourself. Now, it's interesting that he didn't just tell him go.
Right.
He said, go for yourself. And the great commentator on the Torah, Rashi, who was really the beginning point for any discussion about how to properly understand what the verses are telling us, he right there tells us that why does God say to Abraham, for yourself? So he says straight away, he says, L'toivascha v'lehenoscha. He says, for your good and for your benefit. And this is the foundation of how we look at and understand and approach any mitzvah, any commandment in the Torah. Is that if someone breaks Shabbos, someone eats bacon, he's not hurting God. He's not hurting him. If he is doing a positive commandment, he is giving tzedakah, he is putting on his tefillin, so he's not doing God a favor. Is that everything God tells us to do is not for him. God, he is infinite, he is perfect, he has no needs, he's not lacking anything, we can't hurt him, we can't help him. Right? So there's nothing that he tells us to do which is for him. Everything he tells us to do is only for our good and for our benefit. And like any parent, is that he has a much broader perspective than the child on what's going to be good and what's going to be not so good. I can remember quite a few years ago, one of my children, we were actually living in Israel at the time. One of my children was, she's probably about one, something quite young. And it was wintertime in Israel. It gets quite a bit colder in Jerusalem than it does here.
Yes.
And we had the heat on. And it was very, very hot. And so I told my daughter, don't touch. Don't touch the heater. So when she knew she wasn't supposed to touch the heater, but at a particular time when there was no one looking, I guess she thought she was missing out on something really great. So she ran over and touched the heater, and then you hear a shriek, right? Because then she realized maybe it wasn't such a good idea to touch the heater. So, you know, from the perspective of a child, a small child, you know, one could easily make a mistake and say, "Wow, Dad, he's so horrible. He's obviously this is where the good stuff is. He's obviously trying to keep the good stuff for himself. So why he's keeping away from the heater?" So that's not why I told her not to touch the heater.
Of course not.
I told him because it's for her good and it's for her benefit. So if God tells us, he says, "Don't eat bacon." Okay, so why not? I mean, non-Jews can eat bacon. I mean, I'm sure we're not obligated to say it must be because it tastes terrible. I mean, I'm sure it's delicious, right? So why is God keeping the good stuff from us? So God understands that a Jew has a certain type of neshama, which can be damaged by certain things. You know, there are people who are allergic. There are people who are highly allergic to certain foods, the nut allergies, where if they eat nuts, they could actually die.
Right.
So everything which is true in the physical world is there to teach us, to help us understand what's true in the spiritual world. Is that God is not telling us don't eat bacon because it's going to hurt me. And he's not telling us not to eat bacon because he's mean and horrible and wants to keep the good food away from us. He's saying that just like with my daughter, why did I tell her not to touch the heater? Just, my child, I love you. I care about you. I know what's best for you. I have much more experience than you. I have a broader perspective on life than you. And I'm telling you for your own good. Don't touch the heater.
Right.
So God does the same thing with us. Is there are things that there are, just like there are realities, and this is an important point, right? Is that mitzvot, commandments from the Torah, are not simply traditions. They're not simply things we do because that's what our grandparents did, or just, you know, because this is our culture, and that this is that they're realities. And that is really the only way to understand the vital importance of the Torah and of keeping the Torah. Because just like in the physical world, is there are rules. And when I say rules, I don't mean rules like don't go over 60 kilometers per hour in the,
right.
I'm saying there are rules in the, there are physics, there's the rules in physics, there's laws. The laws of physics, there's laws in biology, there's laws in chemistry. And a person cannot ignore those laws. There's something called gravity. If you go to the top of the telecom tower over there and you step off the top of that tower, you could be the nicest guy in the world. You could be good to your mother. You could give lots of charity. You could be, all your friends love you. But there's nothing which is going to free you from the fact that there's something called gravity. And if you step off that, you're going to fall. So in the spiritual, it's the same thing, is that there are things which are going to be spiritually harmful to us. And how would you know what those are? The spiritual world, by definition, is not a world you can see. You know, in the physical world, you can see. You touch the heater and you can feel the consequence immediately. Spiritual isn't like that. Spiritual is that's why God has to tell us. There are things that, just like there's physics, there's metaphysics. Just like there's biology, there's metabiology, there's spiritual biology. And these are the things which are bad for your neshama. These are the things which are good for your neshama.
So when you look through the mitzvot and you realize that there are references which are the explanation of why, it's not just a simple statement of fact, thou shalt not, or thou shalt, or do this, or do, or don't do this. There's an explanation in each one of them which is referenced back to, I suppose, the Torah and other teachings which really explain it and amplify that, so that it's not just a question of, you know, take it or leave it. This is something which there is a logical explanation behind all of them.
So there definitely is an explanation behind all of them. Do we necessarily know the explanation behind all of them? So the mitzvot can be actually divided roughly. There's different ways of categorizing, but you could divide them into roughly two categories. One category is called mishpatim. Mishpatim are things which we could say that they're things that we would understand and relate to. I mean, they make sense to us. They're things that, in fact, you'll find in most societies. For example, honor your mother and father, or don't steal, or don't murder. These are things which our minds can easily relate to, can grasp and understand. They make sense to us.
And there it's these explanations about the consequences, about what the dayanim the judges had to find, and the kind of punishment that was meted out.
Correct. There's consequences, can be consequences in this world, but for us to do that, we would need to have the Sanhedrin, which is the high court, or we'd have to have, you know, certain structure of rabbinical courts in the land of Israel in order to implement certain of the laws down here. But there's also, of course, there's the next world. There's consequences. Right, and then there's a whole second category of mitzvot, of commandments, which are things which we don't necessarily understand why we do them at all. We wouldn't certainly have never come up on our own with the shaking a lulav, or putting on tefillin, or you know, why is it that pork is something which is not kosher, whereas beef is something which is kosher? And these are things which are referred to as chukim, they're simply decrees. Now, which means that we wouldn't have come up with them, and we don't necessarily understand them. It doesn't mean there's not a reason for them, and it doesn't mean that we aren't able to access some of the reasoning behind it. I mean, there are whole books written in Torah literature, which go through what is called the ta'amei ha-mitzvot, the reasons for the commandments. The ultimate reason for any commandment, even the ones that we think we understand, is because God created the world in such a way, whereas if you do certain things, it connects you to Him. And if you do certain things, it breaks your connection to Him. So that is ultimately, and why these things, we don't always understand exactly why, but we can learn lessons from it. The ta'am ayam mitzvah, ta'am also means flavor. Because we aren't supposed to just do things robotically, as we are supposed to emotionally connect to them, to relate to them. So much of learning Torah itself is to understand the world that God created and how things work and why they work. And the more we understand, certainly the deeper and the richer our experience of keeping the mitzvot is. And so it's definitely vital to the extent that we can to understand what we're doing, why we're doing, how to do it, the proper way of doing it, you know, what it means. And it makes the more that we do that, it certainly makes it a deeper and much richer and more meaningful experience.
So as an ordinary mere mortal going out doing the daily chores or going to work or whatever you do during the day, you're not going beyond yourself in the normal course of events. So you know that you wouldn't, and if you had to do some of these things like murder someone or rape somebody or do, you'd really be going out of your way. And in the same way, if you were giving charity, it's a positive way of doing things. It's something that you would have to take the extra step to do. Whereas if you're going to work and you're doing all these things, you know, you're paying your staff, you're doing whatever it is that you have to do. These are things which is taken for granted in the daily life. But in an organization like the Hebrew of David, where you take that extra step to, first of all, to join and belong, and then also to take the step to do the mitzvah of giving of yourself and giving charity and chesed and things around that. That takes a little bit more out of you than, and it's not only for yourself, whereas you're putting on tefillin, you're doing it for yourself. You've started the day, it kind of focuses the mind. But when you're doing something else like that, this is a positive step towards something which you, average person doesn't do. But if you, whatever you do in life, if you're going to do something for others, you are stepping out of your comfort zone and out of what you have to do something for somebody else. That surely is a mitzvah in itself.
Absolutely. And you're touching actually on a very important point, which is one of the reasons why it is very important to even know what the mitzvot are. And there are books available. There's one, I'm sure that, available probably locally in the Jewish bookstores here, which is, by the Chafetz Chaim, where he actually lists, it's a small book, where he goes through the different mitzvot which are applicable today. We said some of them are not because there's no temple, or we don't have the majority of Jews living in the land of Israel, but there are still a large number of mitzvot, of course, that we still can do. But the problem is that you need to know that it's a mitzvah in order to be fulfilling a mitzvah. And there are so many things that people are probably doing already, which are mitzvot, but they don't necessarily realize that they are
a
mitzvah. So let me give you an example. Is that there is a mitzvah in the Torah to pay your worker on time.
Before the sun goes down.
To pay, right, before, depending on exactly how it's structured. If it's someone it's a night job before the end of the night. If it's a day job before the end of the day. Of course, the way things are structured, it could be at the end of the month. It could be, you know, it would depend on exactly what the job and when payment was due. But let's say a very simple example. So this is a Torah mitzvah, one of the 613 commandments. So you have a couple and they decide they'd like to go out to dinner, have a little time to themselves. So they hire a babysitter. So they get a Jewish high school girl comes over and they tell her this, Shlomi's got to be in bed by 7 and this, and read this one a story, and they go off to dinner. They come back at the end of the evening. They hear the report about who didn't behave and who did behave, and then they pay her. So if they're not aware that it's a mitzvah to pay your worker on time, so they paid her, and they paid her. But they're doing the same thing anyway. If you would know that actually paying your worker on time is one of the 613 commandments in the Torah, and I go, wow, I am now paying my babysitter, and I am fulfilling one of the commandments in the Torah. You're taking an act which you were doing anyway, and you're getting eternal reward and connection to the creator of the universe for that simple act. So it's actually very important to know what the mitzvot are, because if you're putting in the effort anyway to be doing a lot of them, so get credit for them, get reward, get the benefit of the relationship with God that they're supposed to build, right? We have to know what the mitzvot are and to know when the opportunity arrives. Otherwise we'll miss out on opportunities.
Yeah. So that's just my point really, is that when you're going about in business, et cetera, these are the things which you people take for granted that you'll do. You, somebody does a job for you, you're going to pay. It's not only for a worker in the true sense of the word, somebody in your employ, but it's somebody who's a subcontractor or a contractor or somebody doing your, something for yourself. So you would want to make sure that you, he also has expenses. So I presume that's where you want to get that account paid or what it is on time. And doing it is fulfilling a mitzvah in the same sense as you were describing.
Certainly, and for the business person, you know, a man or woman who's in business, is there are many, many mitzvot which govern, you know, the way that a Jew is supposed to conduct himself or herself in the context of business transactions, in the context of dealing with money. And it's a very important thing to know. It's not actually the most well-known area of Jewish law, the mitzvot connected to those things, but these are things of vital importance, you know, and it's a real opportunity as well as a Jew who is out in the world, who is engaging in business activities in the world with other Jews, with other non-Jews, has an opportunity to be a real, what's called a Kiddush Hashem, to be a person who is, based on their personal conduct, is someone who represents the Jewish people, represents God in the world in a way where people look at them and say, wow. You know, well, even if they don't know the word, mensch, you know, that look at this man, look at this person and how they behave. Because you talk about people paying on time or paying their accounts I'm sure you can ask anybody in business, and it's not always so easy getting paid. To have someone who pays you on time and as they're supposed to, and you know, that's things which the Torah requires is that's a Kiddush Hashem. These are mitzvot and you would think. That what does business have to do with spirituality? There, you know, spirituality is not just on Shabbos. Is that there is no area of life, there is nothing outside of the framework within which we can connect to God. Is that down to the smallest thing? Is, you know, the way you tie your shoe, if you do it in the right way, you can connect to God. The way that you talk to people, the way that you do business, the way that you, everything.
You tie your shoe left first or right first?
So for men is that you put on your right shoe and then your left, then you tie your left and you put on your right. It gets more confusing if you're lefty sometimes, but let's leave that out.
So they used to talk about some of the rugby players, and they always cited one particular person who was meticulous in how he got dressed. You know, first he put on his pants and his top, you know, et cetera, and then he put on his socks and then his shoes, but it had to be the left first or the right first, whatever it was. And most of these rugby players were only too happy that they managed to put on the shoes, the boots before the socks. Or the other way around. So, you know, that's a kind of thing that you instinctively do. And I suppose, I mean, I know that when I get up, I always do it the same way, but I didn't plan it that way. Somehow it's a habit that I've got into. I'm sure it's the same with everybody. I'm sure people have a process of getting dressed and doing things, not unwittingly, knowing that they're doing it correctly or incorrectly.
Right. And many of these things really are to bring in an awareness into what we're doing and how we live our lives. Because how much of our day is spent on autopilot? You know, just sort of going, you know, sometimes you end up at work and you have no recollection of getting there. You know, I've been driving for half an hour and I have no recollection of even where was your mind on autopilot. So it's actually so easy to sort of to go through life on zombie mode. And there are many of the things in the Torah which actually is trying to get us to be aware of what we're doing and why we're doing and to live with focus.
So when you talk about, when they talk about a tithe that you should give away, in other words, 10% of your earnings, is that the guideline? Is that the strict rule, or is it up to you as an individual how you give and what you give?
So the,
or is that just a guideline for what you should be giving?
So every one who is earning money, and earning enough money to live, because there are people who are unfortunately obviously in a position where they're not even earning enough money to cover their own expenses.
I could do with the 10% extra.
They could do with the 10% extra. And there's, you know, people in the community who are in need.
Absolutely.
So, with, you know, not including those people. And of course, when it comes to anyone's particular situation, you always have to ask a question. You have to ask a rabbi, you know, for your particular situation about how to handle something. But we're speaking in general terms here. Is that, so in general, assuming a person is making a living, is supposed to be a minimum of 10% and a maximum of 20. It shouldn't be more than 20 because you're not supposed to impoverish yourself either. There are exceptions to the 20% rule for people who are exceptionally wealthy. But your average person is between 10 and 20%.
So most people, most of these organizations want you to give till it hurts. Well, it's 20% when it starts to hurt.
For most people, it's 1% it starts to hurt.
Right. Well, they're reaching for the wallet.
But you know what? That also is an interesting point, which is that a mitzvah, by definition, is something which arouses resistance. And there's only mitzvah when there's resistance. So you find, for example, I'll give you an interesting example, is that, believe it or not, is that the mitzvah of getting married applies to men, but does not apply to women. Women do not have a mitzvah to get married, and men do. So I heard an interesting story.
I thought it was a mitzvah for the man to get to have a bride.
It's a mitzvah for the man to get married.
Right.
But the woman doesn't have a mitzvah.
It's the gift that gives it, keeps on giving.
Is your wife listening, Stan?
I hope so.
So you'll get points. So the question is, how could that be? How could that be? So there was, I heard a story. Actually, I heard the story. I think it was many years ago. It was, when Rabbi Tatz was in town, and he was, I think, it may have been the very first Sinai in Daba. I'm not sure if I'm remembering correctly. But he said his daughter asked him this question. And he said, why, how could it, maybe I saw a man, maybe I shouldn't get married. God doesn't want me to get married, right? So he said that his rabbi was coming to town, to, London, where he lives. His Rav was Rav Moshe Sapir, Zecher Zal Tovracha, one of the great rabbis of the generation. And he brought his daughter to ask the question. And he, Rav Shapiro gave the answer that, the principle we're discussing now is that for men, why is there a mitzvah to get married? He says that they have a mitzvah particularly because for men there's resistance. Is that when it comes to commitment issues, you know, nowadays, okay, women can also have, but generally, if there's someone resisting the commitment to the relationship, you'll find it's the man and not the woman. Is that, and I am generalizing, and of course there are exceptions, but in general, I think experience shows, is that women will, in general, you'll find that they'll want a relationship, and the guy is feeling a little bit, you mentioned the M word, and he suddenly, he's, gosh, look at the time. So he said, he answered that since women naturally will have a tendency to want the relationship, so there is no mitzvah, of course God wants them to get married, but he doesn't command them because commandment, mitzvah, and resistance go together. So it's not, the fact that there's a resistance isn't a problem. The fact that there's resistance is natural. Wherever you have a mitzvah, it is the very act of overcoming the resistance where the greatness lies, where the growth comes in, where the connection comes in. So giving tzedakah is hard for people. You know, there is a resistance to parting with your money, and there's all kinds of excuses why not, and why not today, and why, but it is the resistance is what makes it mitzvah, because mitzvah and resistance go hand in hand.
So research has actually shown, as far as giving is concerned, that if people come to an event or they're going to give anything or they're going to buy anything for that matter, if they take out cash, they tend to spend less. So if you can catch them with a credit card, they tend to be a little bit more generous because it's not actually physically handing over the cash. But if they had to go dip into their wallet and pull out cash, it somehow jars with them, and it's a kind of a resistance to that, as you were saying. Whereas a credit card tends to be a little bit easier, and the research has actually shown that since the credit cards came into the shopping experience, etc. In fact, there was a program earlier today on Chai FM talking about exactly that credit cards have changed the way people shop, the amount of money that they give and what they do. And I think it applies equally. I know when we have events, when people bring their credit cards, we tend to be able to pull a little bit more than we would if they were handing over hard cash.
Do you know, interestingly, the research also shows the opposite as well, the other way around, is that people find it easier to steal when they don't relate to what they're stealing as being real money. So if you're stealing via, a transfer, where it's something which is not as tangible, is that it's easier for people to rationalize and to justify their stealing because they don't relate to it so much as if they were going sticking their hand in someone's pocket.
Yes, I think that I can relate to that. I understand that precisely. So, Rabbi, it's been particularly interesting. We could go on talking about this all night because I have another. We've covered two or three mitzvot, and I could probably ask you another 610 or so. But we'll come to that on another occasion. And thank you very much. Would you like to say a little bit about Aish and yourself and where are we going?
So I'm here with as one of the rabbis at Eshet Torah, and hopefully many people in the community are familiar with Eshet Torah. We've been around for more than 20 years and have impacted the lives, I think, of certainly hundreds and I think even thousands of people in the community through their children and family. And is that we are very passionate about getting Jews connected to the Jewish people, getting Jews connected to Judaism, understanding why it's important to be Jewish, what it means to be Jewish, and getting people on their own level, in their own way, and, you know, never were in a way which we think is user-friendly, in a way which is caters to people's individual needs, is getting them to ask the questions and find out the answers about what is life about and how does the Judaism, how does Torah answer those questions. And so we're involved in the schools. Okay. We have rabbis going into the schools and teaching kids. We're involved with university students, young professionals, with families, with, you know, all across the spectrum. Trips, you know, to Israel. We have trips going to India, to Thailand, you know, the social justice trips and learning trips, experiential trips, classes. You know, JWRP, women's trips to Israel, men's trips. So we have all across the spectrum. And that's really what we're passionate about, getting the South African Jewish community to connect to what it means to be Jewish and why it matters, why it's important, and to really experience the beauty and the depth and the meaning of what it means to be Jewish, because we really believe is that, like we said, like God told Abraham, it's for your own good and for your own benefit. And once a person gets a taste of real, genuine, Jewish growth, is they always want more.
So the Hebrew order of David falls exactly into a part of that. Of course, we don't, do any religious teaching or religious aspects of it. We're totally non-denominational in that regard, except for the Jewish part. But we, as an organization, want to reach out to Jews. We want them to join. We want them to participate in the activities of what we have available. And we have projects where we assist those in need. One of the projects is we have a Bringing Yontov Joy, which we're busy with at the moment, where together with Kosher Mobile Meals, we're delivering to the in poor areas here and in the Eastern Cape, and we'll expand it into Cape Town soon. One of our lodges in Cape Town is also doing it. And if you want to contact the Hebrew Order of David to donate, there are notices out in the public at the moment. We tend to send out a lot of notices to the public. And I have to really commend the Jewish community for its generosity. And you can send to admin@hodavid.org, or you can call me or call the office at 011-640-3017. We'll take your call, we'll take your money, and it's been a pleasure having you here, Rabbi. You're always somebody who has an easy way of talking, an easy way of explaining, and it's a pleasure to listen to you. You did all the talking, and I hope that everybody learned something tonight. Wish everybody a good Shabbos and a good night from the Hebrew Order of David, HOD Hour, and Rabbi Gedalia Kaufman.
Get your brand out there.
But it's too expensive.